This page consists of selections from three different works by Evagrius Ponticus that touch on the question of avarice. The first section is from the Practicos, and if we could look at chapters 9, 18, and 26, notice that in number 9, the principal work of the demon of avarice, the principal temptation, consists in a kind of despair or fantasy about the worst possible scenario that could happen if you give away what you have. A kind of fear that if you give away what you have in order to become part of a religious community or act compassionately towards others, that at the end of your life you will have terrible needs that you won't be able to take care of. Avarice suggests long old age, hands powerless to work, hunger and disease, the bitterness of poverty, the disgrace of receiving the necessities of life from others. So the principal problem of avarice, and remember here, of course, he's writing for hermits and for people who live in very strict monastic communities, the problem is not so much possession per se, but the fantasy, the horrible foreboding of what may happen in the future because one has chosen a kind of life that excludes having possessions that could be security. Therefore, the temptation to avarice is the temptation to stockpile, imagining that you will need these things to protect yourself in the future. He says then in number 18 that just as life and death can't coexist at the same time in the same subject, so love, agape, cannot coexist with wealth. Love is, and particularly in the senses we've seen of kenosis, the divine outpouring, love destroys wealth. It gives wealth away, and it even, in a sense, gives away this temporal life. Christ gives away his life for us. We are called upon, in a sense, to give away our lives for others, too. He gives a remedy in number 26. Gifts, giving gifts to others, quench nasi kakia, that is to say, rancor or the memory of injury. Doing something kind for another, and remember he's talking about people who don't have much to give, will quench this tendency towards meditating, ruminating on wrong deeds. Lady Macbeth nursing wrath to keep it warm. In the same way, here there's a reminder of the possibility that there is a ruminating on past injuries that can be absolutely destructive of the soul. And giving gifts to others will be part of the cure. And he says towards the end of this chapter, we who are poor should make up for our lack of other things by being hospitable at table. We may not have gifts to give people in a formal sense, but we can give them what food we possess and invite them to share our table hospitality. He then, in Numbers 97 and 99, gives some vignettes and citations of his own favorite spiritual authorities. In 97, a passage that was destined to be repeated and even to become famous in the Apothegmena, the sayings of the Desert Fathers, and it's recounted as well by Cassian, as we'll see in his first conference. The idea that one of the brethren had only a copy of the Gospels, and he sold it, gave the money to feed the hungry, saying, I have sold the book which told me, sell what you have and give it to the poor. A kind of a lovely irony of taking the thing that invites you to dispossess and dispossessing yourself of even that. Now there is a controversy, a natural controversy within the monastic tradition. Is it a sign of avarice to possess books? And of course those who emphasize the importance and value of knowing, meditating on the scriptures and the whole practice of Lectio Divina say, no, it's not an excess, it's an important spiritual practice. Those who are more skeptical will say you shouldn't have lots of books because they're a sign of wealth. And that controversy dates to the very earliest years of monasticism, and we can see it already hinted at in this passage. In number 99, he quotes a monk who says that he cuts back in pleasures in order to cut back excuses for anger. Then he says, and if we drop to the second half of this, a kind of an interesting comparison, one of the old men said that charity, again, love, compassion, does not know how to store up food or money. And he also says, and this could even be more important, I am not aware of ever having been taken in by the same demon twice on the same point. A reminder that we have to be aware of the way we are tempted and not succumb in the ways that we have been tempted in the past. But here again is a repetition of the idea that real compassion doesn't hoard things, but seeks rather to share them, to give them away. In the second selection from Evagrius, this text from the Perilogismon simply uses the example of avarice to engage in a very interesting spiritual reflection, and I would advise you to spend as much time on this as you find it interesting to yourselves. And it's an invitation to take the experience of temptation and turn it into an experience of lectio on life, seeing the deeper meaning of the events that happen, even the temptations to sin that happen. He says if you want to really upset the demons, if you want to turn their sword back into their own hearts, then when you're tempted, distinguish between what is the temptation, what are the concerns of which it's composed, and how does it especially afflict or affect your intellect, your nous. Let's say, he says, for example, that you're tempted by avarice, the logismos we're studying. Well, distinguish, he says, between the intellect, the nous, the contemplative organ that receives the temptation on the one hand, the idea of gold, the subject of the temptation on the other, then the gold itself, the real substance that exists in the world, and then the passion or addiction of avarice itself. Then ask yourself, can the problem or the sin lie in the nous? Well, no, certainly not. The nous is the image of God. Does it lie in the idea of gold? No. Does it lie in the gold itself? No, that's a good part of God's creation. Well, therefore, the problem of sin is, he would say, finally, a pleasure that hates humankind. There is a deep anti-human pleasure that urges the nous to abuse the things that God has created. So sin will consist in the wrong use of good creations. And it's that tendency to misuse things that God calls us to cut off. So that, he says, is a good approach to the question of temptation, and it uses the example of avarice, even though the text itself is not concerned, strictly speaking, with details of that temptation. The third and final section is actually rather long. I've given you quite a few selections from Evagrius's Anti-Rheticos. There was some interest in this text in past weeks, and so I've given you a little more from it. There are a fair number of translations of this in the book Ascetic Behavior in Greco-Roman Antiquity, edited by Vincent Wimbush, and O'Loughlin offers a translation from the Syriac of a number of passages which I have generally reworked in the section that lies before you. Let's look at just a couple of these representative examples. These, remember, are passages that Evagrius wants the monks and nuns to memorize so that they can use them at the right time. And there are various different kinds of them. They're not all to be used against the demons or against the tempting thoughts, although quite a few of them are. They are also sometimes for ourselves, for interior reflection. One might say for a kind of brief lectio when we're tempted in a particular way. And in some cases, they represent prayers that we address to the Lord. At the very first one, he recommends, for the demons who announce within my mind while I sleep, you should send to one of your relatives or some rich person to send you gold. He uses Genesis, and remember, his methodology is to work through all the books of the Bible, progressively selecting what he thinks are the best and most appropriate passages. I will stretch out my hand to the God who made heaven and earth. I will not take anything from all of your goods. That's the passage you say to that temptation. The next one, number 3-5, for the avaricious tempting thought that closes the heart, literally closes off the splankna, the bowels of mercy, against someone who begs for life's necessity and counsels those of us who live as hermits or solitaries to hoard or store up things, the passage, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, the next ones are very interestingly taken from the Elijah cycle. Evagrius particularly emphasizes the role of Elijah. Let's skip number 3:13 and number 3:14 and look at 3:15, because this image will come up again in Cassian. For the soul that receives gold, ostensibly on behalf of others for business purposes, but stung by desire, desires to retain it, forgetting the leprosy of Gehazi. Let the reader understand how Elisha the prophet had mastery over the tempting thought of avarice, which is the first of the evil passions, and over the remaining passions that circle around it, from which are engendered these chronic tempting thoughts, and hinder the noose through evil habits, rendering it leprous. He here suggests that avarice is the first of the evil passions, not that he's changing his traditional order. Evagrius is not changing the order that really begins with the idea that gluttony is the first, but he's using the biblical sense of the love of money. Avarice is the root of all evil. He's referring to the New Testament biblical model, which of course is itself a citation of Old Testament tradition, that there is another sense in which avarice is the root of all evil. And here he uses the whole passage in which Gehazi is stricken with leprosy because of his misuse of external possessions of gold. This is an example which Evagrius highlights and which Cassian will reiterate in his texts as well. Dropping down just to a couple of others, 3:19 is particularly fun. For the soul that we condemn or that we judge as demonically inspired, because that person doesn't possess, we think, adequate intelligence, enough intelligence to administer the goods that God has given to us. This is really a verse for us when we condemn another person as incapable of proper administration of goods that we think should be used otherwise. And then he advises two verses: the sinner watches the righteous and seeks to slay him, but the Lord will not leave him in his hand, nor by any means condemn him when he is judged. We must be more merciful in our judgments and not condemn others. And I'll leave you to glance at these verses and see the extent to which you find them useful yourself.